When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to another Motorsport Issue Preview podcast. I'm Joe Dunn and I'm the editor of Motorsport, and I'm joined today by some of our team who are going to talk you through the issue, or the last two issues of Motorsport, and hopefully explain a little bit about how the stories came about, what the challenges were, and really what we think of the magazine. So let me introduce you first of all to Damon Cogman.
Hello.
He's our art director. Simon Aaron.
Hello there.
Our features editor, and our photographer, Lyndon McNeil.
Hello.
And Jack Phillips,
digital editor,
is also joining us to talk a little bit about what's going on online. We've been away for a couple of months, which means that we have two issues to get through. The first is going to be the July issue, which is our Le Mans preview magazine. And let's dive straight in and talk about the cover, which features a group of very, very handsome young men. Damon, tell us a bit about how this cover came about.
Did you say handsome young men, comma Damon, or was that a stretch? Well, it was a marvellous experience, Jack. And Lyndon went off to go and meet all the drivers themselves and photograph them. So they could probably tell you about that side. I could tell you about the cover side of it, about building it. But I'm going to punch it straight over to the other guys first.
It's quite stressful, Lyndon, that day.
On the day, it was very stressful. The build-up wasn't too bad. It was a lot of emails, as you know, Jack, from pinging back and forth between PR people, asking if we can have them, speaking to the FIA, seeing if we could get a room. Thankfully, the FIA pulled out all the stops.
A room to shoot the photo.
Not just a room for somewhere to sleep. So we turned up to Spa with hopefully PRs knowing what we needed to do and the FIA sorting us out. And when we saw the PRs, they were all like, oh, still happening. So it was... It was a bit of a surprise for everyone on the day.
Because the idea behind this, wasn't it, was to get the sort of young British GTE drivers all together in one room, acting up and playing for the camera. Yeah. And it's something that you think might be easy, but actually, because all the drivers are very busy and because they drive for rival manufacturers, it's actually really, really difficult to get them in the same room.
It was, yeah. We were kind of... Everyone agreed to it in principle, but then obviously they've all got their own different agendas for the day, pit stop practice and drivers' briefings and everything else. The FIA had their big group photo in the morning, and we just...
Didn't you basically get them all on the way back from that photo?
Yeah,
they were all around.
They were all in overalls, and it was like herding sheep. It was... Jack managed to speak to the PAs and the PR guys, and they were like, yeah, grab them now, you've got 10 minutes. And I think...
It was like a school trip. We were walking along.
just making sure they didn't get sort of distracted
There were a couple stragglers at the end. I won't mention their names.
No, let's mention names. Let's mention names.
It was Darren and Andy.
First of all, for readers who might not have the magazine in front of them, who have we got on the cover?
So we've got, from left to right, we've got Darren Turner, Sam Bird, Andy Prio, Alex Lynn and Harry Tinknell. It was brilliant.
Out of all of these, obviously, when we say young chargers, obviously there are a couple in there that are
slightly less younger.
And ironically, the ones that were the most
difficult
badly behaved
were the two gentlemen.
Yeah, don't say old.
Yeah, so they were kind of taking selfies on Eau Rouge and everything else and just basically dragging their heels. But we're all up for it and keen to do it, so yeah.
But overall, we got a cracking picture out of it. I mean, we had to build a little bit of we had to push them all together a bit in the imagery, just to kind of sort of for the purposes of the cover. But But by and large, that the image that's on the cover
is what was shot there and then. Yeah. There were three other drivers.
Yes,
in
we had
that
Harry.
One shot.
We had
James Collado,
Johnny Adam, James Collado, and another.
Should we have a look at the picture and see?
Yes, but some of them were there, some of them weren't. Some of them were sort of pushed together, so we had to sort of cheat a bit. But by and large, they were all there.
Well, I think it's a cracking image and something different. I mean, we often for our Le Mans preview issue, we will, you know, it's very easy in a way, isn't it, to put a LMP1 car on there. They look fantastic. But for this year, we sort of thought we'd do something different and focus a bit more on the personalities, and also focus on a different class. And Jack, it's your feature. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to sort of focus on the GTE class.
Well, it's the class where most people are being paid. And it has the most manufacturers, it has the most professionals. Unfortunately, there was no actual Brits on the top step, despite how we sold it.
We had a lot of options, didn't we?
Well, this is in hindsight, isn't it? But at the time when we were putting this together, our thought talk us through what the sort of thought process was.
The thread through the class is Brits, and very different stories behind them as well. Because you've got Darren, who's been in it. He's been in GTs for years. Andy Prio's come from touring cars, obviously world champion. Then you had the single-seated converts, Sam Bird, Alex Lynn, Alex Sims. But then you've also got Harry, who is kind of a bit of both, because he's been in sports cars since 2014, which he's only 24 years old, so he's probably been a sports car driver now longer than he was a single-seated driver. But there were lots of different stories that were all interweaved. Because the young guys all drove together as well, and it was good to get them talking about each other and looking back on when they were together, and that they're all amazed that they were actually professional sports car drivers, which is quite a nice story. And just needed one of them to win Le Mans, but it wasn't to be.
we know that now. We know that now. Yeah. Obviously, we also featured the Friends Reunited bit here. Jensen and Fernando meeting at Le Mans again. Obviously, Fernando won the race. It seems a long time ago now, doesn't it? But it really was an amazing kind of Le Mans this year, in the sense that it had a kind of an energy which maybe in previous years wasn't around quite so much. Was that right?
I mean, it did, because of the media interest surrounding Fernando, despite the relative lack of competition at the sharp end of the field. I think it's another interesting thing about the GTE. I mean, traditionally, even when LMP1 was really competitive, Porsche, Audi, Toyota, I mean, the racing was perhaps slightly better still in the GTE class. And I think that's just been such a thing now for so many years. But yeah, at the sharp end of the field, Fernando's presence actually gave the race a little more of a... It's well followed around the world, we all know that. But this year, national newspapers, which might give it a couple of paragraphs on a generous day, suddenly, with Alonso's presence, were much more interested. And I think it's right that the broader media should heed what's going on at Le Mans, because it's been going since 1920, flipping three, for Christ's sake. It is a great event.
Absolutely, and obviously we went to press before we knew the results, but this is as good a time as any just to talk briefly about Toyota. We're happy for them, we're pleased.
Absolutely thrilled, yeah. I mean, they've been having enough cracks at it over the years, so to sort of do it in the way that they've done now. And actually, to be fair to Toyota as well, they let the two cars go racing,
mostly, yeah.
Which everyone was a bit nervous about, obviously pre-race, because we thought there might be a tortoise and hare, they might pre-stage an Alonso victory. And in the end, they actually went toe-to-toe.
And he was very good as well, which was, he during the night, he was the quickest man there, quicker than Conway.
You were looking at some stats, weren't you, Jack?
David Hanmeyer Hansen tweeted the averages of all the LMP1 drivers, and he was quickest by something like half a second. Yeah. And
that's amazing. That's not, bear in mind who else is in that car.
Yeah.
So that wraps up our preview content. Continued. We had a Alex Brundle talked us around the circuit in the magazine. Simon, you did a lovely piece about your first visit to Le Mans, and we also had Dickie did a track test of the 908 Peugeot 908, didn't he?
Which Lyndon got absolutely soaked during
and less than ideal weather conditions.
Yeah. When you were in the back of a car.
I was in the back of our tracking photos for this. Long-termer, and the aerodynamics of it meant that it sucked in more water than was on the track. I was sodden after two laps of the, was it National Circuit at Silverstone?
Ironically, Dickie was much warmer
Dickie
and drier.
Dickie was drier in a car full of holes than I was in a Jag.
As was I standing in the pit garage. Yeah. It was a much better place to be.
Well, I've got to say, you did a brilliant job, because I mean the main picture you can see that it is in torrential rain, but then there's some lovely sort of shots of it in the pits.
Well, I had plenty of time to shoot it because it didn't go out for very often.
I think that opening spread, I think Andy did a really good job.
Typography is great. Yeah. So we've got an amazing typography. Yeah, that's where, and the story of getting in a 908 in torrential conditions
for the first time to drive that.
Yeah,
then,
quite a nerve-wracking experience, I'm sure, for Dick. If he was here, I'm sure he'd tell a story about it.
So moving on through the magazine and through our features, we've got a piece authored by someone. What's this? Don't recognise this name. Tiffany Dell.
Who's that guy?
Who is he? Who's written a really lovely kind of sort of rose-tinted memories, really, of Thruxton, which is his local racetrack, and is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And Tiff wrote a lovely piece about remembering going to the track as a boy and watching his heroes racing there. And he's got a nice way with words, actually, Simon, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. When I used to interview him when he was a career racing driver, 35, 40 years ago, whenever it was, I'm not sure he was as articulate then, but he's a great guy, Tiff, and he's what you see on the box. I mean, he comes across as being very articulate, and you wonder, is that scripted? But he's actually a very natural front man. He is. He's got a great passion
for the sport, even to this day, isn't he? He's just one of the good guys, isn't he?
Absolutely, and despite being, I don't know, is he 133, 134? I mean, he's still racing his historic Formula Ford, his old Lotus that he raced back in the day. And that is the mark of an enthusiast, in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the passion really comes through in that piece as well. We've got a lunch with Steve Parrish, which, Simon, lunch. It wasn't
breakfast. It was brunch. mid-morning. Yes, very, very enjoyable.
How did you keep him on the leash? Because I imagine with Steve it's a case of keeping it clean.
Well, when we sat down for coffee, we said, look, I know that blowing up brothels and stuff is all very well, but we would actually like to talk about motorcycle racing. And if you want to chuck in the occasional wild moment, that's all well and good. But we wanted to focus on his career because a lot of people know him as a TV presenter. A lot of people are aware of some of the outrageous deeds and exploits with which he has been associated. But he was, he was a very serious racer. I mean, Barry Sheen identified him as a young rising talent and wanted him in the Suzuki team with him in 1977. It never quite worked out for him in motorcycle Grand Prix racing, but he won lots of national championships, including beating Sheen to the British title one year. He was a pretty flipping good racer. I mean, he says himself that the new book he's just done, Parrish Times. Is it called Parrish Times?
It is Parrish Times.
I just suddenly, ooh, is that what it's called? He said to me that the reason a lot of it is about the escapades, the off-track stuff, is because he doesn't feel he could justify writing a book about his own career as a motorcycle racer. But when you actually look at the stats, he wasn't at the level of a Sheen or a Roberts as far as the history books are concerned, but he was extremely good.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, it wasn't just motorcycle. I mean, he talks about his truck. Well, he was truck racing for longer.
His truck racing career was incredibly successful. I don't know whether he's still the most crowned European.
We all kind of grew up in a sort of watching race bikes. So when he went to trucks, we were like, oh, okay. This is...
You say we. I grew up with him in trucks.
All right. But his prowess in a lorry, in a truck, was great. I mean, he was great fun. He threw the things around and he enjoyed himself. You know, I guess that's the thing about Steve. He's always enjoyed what he does, and you know, he's still got a smile on his face. He still messes around. He still acts like a teenager. When Susie Perry kind of we were talking to her at the Hall of Fame, she mentioned a few of his stories, and so yeah, he's fun to be around. He's a fun guy.
and as with Tiff, I mean, the enthusiasm that fired him as a sort of 15, 16-year-old when he was tearing around an airfield on a motorbike, he still has
still
that.
There.
He's still
and
there.
I think you've podcasted him as well, Jack,
just,
haven't you?
Just yesterday, we recorded the podcast, which doesn't step too much on the toes of the brunch, but it was good research material.
So look out for that being...
Yeah, it should be out on the Royal Automobile Club's YouTube maybe 2-3 weeks, I think. It'll be on our website as well, so...
Brilliant. I look forward to hearing that. From Steve Parrish, we move on to Mark Hughes' feature on McLaren, a very prescient piece, given that this was written almost 2 months ago, on the problems that McLaren was facing. Headline: battered and broken, with a nice typographical kind of effect there as well, and a lovely picture actually of a very kind of bruised looking nose cone, orange or papier orange nose cone there.
As a McLaren fan, that pained me to bolt that together, that feature, because it was
we all want them
to do better, much better, and we want them to succeed, and we want them to be at the front of the grid, and they're kind of, if ever, they're so far away.
Yeah,
it's painful.
Well, I mean, it's one of those stories, isn't it, that unfortunately is going to run, and actually Mark identified, I think, you know, one of the key things he identified in this piece was the sort of the fractured nature of the organisation and the outfit, and how there had been silos had developed within McLaren, which was having an effect, and I think over the last sort of 6 weeks we've probably seen that blow up. We're talking now a couple of days after Boullier has left the company. What happened, Simon?
Eric Boullier tendered his resignation and it was accepted. I mean, that is the marketing speak for whether he's blindfolded and lined up against the wall, I don't know. But
Mark hints at that sort of that might be on the way, doesn't he, in this piece here?
Did you give him a Freddo?
But it's quite interesting that around the time that Red Bull has just committed to the engines McLaren cast aside, nobody's asking the question, what the hell is Red Bull doing? They're all asking the question, what the hell's going on at McLaren?
Mm, absolutely, yeah. Well, now we go through, we have our watch supplement in this issue, which some readers have said they think takes away from some of the motorsport, but I would reiterate, as I think we have done in the past, that these pages are in addition to what we write. So there we get extra pages because of these watches, and actually some of the content and some of these watches I think is top notch in any case, and we arrive at Pike's Peak. Which is a preview of the famous American hill climb. We've interviewed Sebastian Loeb about who was the outright record holder, and this was obviously done pre the race from a couple of weeks ago, which we are still recovering from.
Which we were all convinced could never be broken. And then here
we are. Just flies about half an hour.
We're all sitting around in the office saying, the Volkswagen electric car, no chance.
Can't
never,
beat it.
Never going to get,
15 seconds quicker.
Yes, shows how much we know.
Well, we make the point in the piece, don't we, that even Peugeot's theoretical calculations didn't, or came in with a higher time than Loeb actually achieved, and so he actually went faster than the engineers and boffins thought he could. But so it's actually incredible that Volkswagen has what it's done. I think, but it's a fantastic race, and it's a great story. Us looking back on the history of it,
continues to capture the imagination, doesn't it? And the manufacturers going there sort of carries the mythology on and on, doesn't it? We, I mean, you could argue that the manufacturers are sort of maybe taking a little bit of the sort of sport away, taking a little bit of the fun away. But all of that still goes on. All the people turning up in their trucks, turning up on motorbikes, turning up in home-built specials, it's all still happening.
But isn't it fantastic that some, like a big manufacturer like Volkswagen are so keen to hold the record and who's going to do it next year and who's going to continue the...
They did need some good PR in the States, didn't they?
Well, yeah, they did. They did after the emissions gate, but... The fact that they're prepared to do it and put all their money into it, that is their now racing project rather than let's go TCR.
Maybe we're about to live through a period of record breaking. You know, with Porsche kind of having their sort of crack at the Nürburgring. I mean, maybe there is this newfound love of
speed records.
Let's hope so. Yeah,
the Le Mans TT record just went.
Of course, yeah. Maybe.
Well, if only someone would write some content about record breaking. Yeah.
Look out for a future feature.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Matt Oxley, we've done, this is our final feature for the July issue. Matt Oxley has written a great piece about turn of the century American motorcyclists and who competed in what were called motodromes. This is board track racing, isn't
Murderdromes.
Murderdromes.
Well, they
motodromes, nicknamed Murderdromes on account of how many riders lost their lives competing. And it's classic Matt, isn't it, Simon? It's just beautifully done.
It's fantastic. I mean, his capacity for research and insight and to turn the copy around and beautifully phrased. It's epic. He's a wonderful writer, and it's a privilege to have him as part of the team. And there are two frustrating things here, actually. One, that I've never been to Pikes Peak, and two, that I wasn't around to watch board track racing, you know.
In 1912.
Yeah, I realise if I was, I wouldn't be here now.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure you can't have it both ways.
That's one of the things, if I get my hands on a TARDIS, that's on the bucket list.
Right. Well, I'm going to skip through the rest. We've got some. We've got road tests. Frankel's road test, where we've got a Morgan amongst others. We've got Speed Shop. We've got you with theirs. All the sort of regulars that people love. And we're going to jump straight forward to the current issue, which is on sale in the shops at the moment. This is the cover with Jackie Stewart driving at Silverstone, and it's part of our Silverstone 70th anniversary special. So, I mean, Damon, let's start right again at the front. That lovely image. I mean, it's the fantastic blue, isn't it?
We tried to find a iconic. I'll use that word again. Image for Silverstone, and surprisingly, Silverstone, because of its geography, is actually quite a challenge because it's quite a flat place. So when you sort of try and it's easy when you've got, like, say, Monaco or all the kind of famous tracks of the world have all got this kind of thing that sort of identifies them. The Silverstone is a tricky one because it's very flat. So there's no hills, there's no sort of buildings, there's no anything. All you can do is really kind of have the angle of the car, the grandstands in the background, and the actual bits that say Silverstone are kind of really tricky to find. But I think we found it. I think when you look at that image, you think Silverstone. You know that's Silverstone.
It's first corner. Everybody knows, like you say, everyone knows that's Cops Corner, and sadly, you'll never be able to get that shot again.
No.
It's one of those that has disappeared. One of the only shots from Silverstone has gone. They always used to stand right on the inside,
on the white line, effectively, didn't they? Where they, when they were sort
and
of...
drifting through.
Yeah. You know, there were two. There were Copps and Woodcote, where people, the photographers stood on the inside, where you got a similar... It is fabulous. I mean, it highlights the level of suspension movement in a 1969 Formula One car, which is something we don't see nowadays. It's got drama, it's got movement, it's got Jackie Stewart, it's great.
And of course it echoes that brilliant race that him and Rin had, which was a legendary race that's in the feature, of course.
And some great names as well on that cover. So we've got Lewis Hamilton, Murray Walker, Nigel Mansell, obviously Jackie, and that forms the backbone of the feature, really, doesn't it? It's great drivers
from eight decades,
and one great commentator remembering 8 decades of Britain's premier racetrack. Which, as Simon mentions in the introduction, could well have been Snitterfield.
Yes, well, when they were searching for a home at which to reignite Grand Prix racing in the aftermath of World War II, they were looking around discarded airfields, and they eventually Snitterfield in Warwickshire, just near Stratford-upon-Avon, was an option. But Silverstone, where I think members of the, I can't remember if it's the Fraser Nash Owners Club or something, been surreptitiously doing some races of their own and taking out the odd sheep, was inspected and got the... I mean, they didn't really turn it into a racetrack, of course, in 1948. They just stuck some oil drums up and a bit of rope and, you know, kind of plotted a figure-eight course and told them to get on with it. But
kind of, well, that went on for a few years as well. The oil drums kind of made...
Oh, the oil drums, yeah. I mean,
the
figure-eight was only used once, with the cars coming from opposite... ends of the same runway towards each other in the middle and then separating.
Right, yeah.
So they had a closing speed of getting on for 280, 300 miles an hour or something, and an oil drum and a couple of straw bales between
them. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, nothing did go wrong, but for some reason they went to perimeter roads only from 1949.
Yeah, thankfully common sense prevailed.
And I have to say that talking to Murray Walker about the 1948 race, his powers are, I mean, bearing in mind, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, I've known him long enough, he's 94 and a half, and his cerebral capacity is extraordinary. The detail he can conjure just to the click of a finger. You ask him something, right, Murray, 1948, oh yeah, my mum's Morris Minor, I remember, and he's off. And I just spent 15, 20 minutes chatting to him at Silverstone, and it was just a delight. I could have sat there all day, and I'm sure if he hadn't been dragged off to do something else, he could have talked all day.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, his memory is brilliant, and I mean and actually in the piece, I mean, you're talking about the oil drums being there, and he says, you know, there were in 48 there were bits of barbed wire, bits of old aircraft that were left over, but nobody cared because racing was back. It's a really, really lovely read. Just on that opening page, actually, Damon, I wanted to ask you about the lovely little imagery there that you've got on the left-hand side.
Yeah, it's just a little artistic flourish. The programmes have always been, in motorsport, have always kind of signified a moment in time. They've kind of always reflected the design, the kind of the cars, the typography, everything that kind of sums up the era. So it was kind of nice to kind of dig back in the files and find... things that represented that from the very first 1948, where it's a lovely oil painting and kind of this whizzy zoomy kind of effect, all the way through to the slightly
tobacco advertising everywhere.
Yeah, that's it. Lots of fag brands, lots of booze from the 70s and then into the 80s, and then there's this kind of weird abstract kind of concept stuff we have now, which is looks fantastic, but you wouldn't say that was particularly... it's hard to think that in 70 years' time we'll look back on those and go, those were amazing.
but it's also, I mean, the earlier programme covers, and even the ones mispersed with advertising, they say Formula One, motor racing. I mean, some of the more modern abstract ones, what's all that about?
It could be a concert poster, it could be anything. There's no... which hopefully... Hopefully the new incumbents will kind of redress, because they want people to fall back in love with motor racing, Formula One again. Start with the programmes, guys. God, it's a shout out. We'll do it here. We'll take it on. We'll do it.
Well, let's hope Silverstone sees more anniversaries as the home of the British Grand Prix. That all seems to be in the air at the moment, yeah. Doesn't it? So just to run through it, we've got Murray Walker on the... so we take it decade by decade. Murray Walker on the 1940s. We've got Dennis Jenkinson, who we've done an extract from his report from for the 1950s decade. Got Sir Jackie Stewart, the 1960s. We've got John Watson of the 1970s. These people fairly easy to get hold of in the end, weren't they, Simon? Because everyone has a memory from Silverstone.
Some of them were. I'm still waiting for Emerson Fittipaldi to return to answer my email or return the call. But I got hold of John very easily. But he wanted to talk about Montjuïc Park in '75 because he said he had a much better story about that. But I managed to steer him.
And it's I'm going to call
him at some point and talk about Montjuïc in '75. But I did eventually get him onto the subject of Silverstone. He wasn't a major player that day, but it was just quite interesting because he had very clear memories. I mean, I remember thinking the race was, you know, all the drama in 1973 with the mass pile-up and everything else, and everyone thought, well, you know, what's going to happen this time? And the race just settled down, a shower early on, a couple of cars crashed, Tom Price went out, Regazzoni spun. And you watching it on telly, TV coverage wasn't great in those days because you get buggering off to Haydock Park to watch a horse race and then coming back for a few laps of motor racing. But as the race, and all the cars are spaced out, nothing much was happening, and then, bang, cloud burst, and it was chaos. And Watty had some very clear and very vivid recollections of seeing this sort of mirror effect of the water on the surface and then hitting a ridge of water, which just carried him off in a way, and he was a helpless passenger as he sort of spun around and joined the other 10 cars in the catch fencing, whatever it was. It was, it was just nice to go back and actually talk to someone who was in the middle of it all.
You also managed to speak to Nigel Mansell, Johnny Herbert, David Coulthard, and I think Mark Hughes actually also managed to get hold of Lewis Hamilton, who gives us a typically sort of idiosyncratic kind of memory of Silverstone, and it all comes together as a great kind of a great kind of read, really, as a package together, all those different memories building up a picture of Silverstone. We've got a this is interesting, isn't it? The changing face of Silverstone, Damon, which shows you were mentioning before about the track in 1948, and we've got a page showing how the circuit has changed shape and layout over the years and over the decades.
Yeah, it was a tricky one to narrow it down to fit enough on the page because the changes have been incredible over the years. They've changed pretty much every few years. So we took the major changes. So it's not every single change because some corners got reprofiled, a new building was added or whatever. But this is the major sort of changes all the way through from 1948 sort of idea of them careering towards each other towards today's challenging track where it's sort of God knows how many tracks within one now, isn't it? It's about three or four within one actual layout. It's incredible. The amount of options that they have these days is mind-boggling.
I would love to know what average speed a modern car would do on the classic 52 to 75 layers, or even the one where Keke Rosberg set the first ever 160 mile an hour average lap in 85. I'd love to know what would they do.
Well, they were going through Abbey at 180 miles an hour in those days, so God knows what they'd be doing now.
I mean, 33 years ago, Rosberg averaged 160 miles an hour plus just over 160. So on that circuit in a modern car, I mean, I've been laughing in sort of 47 seconds. I don't know.
All we need to do is get Silverstone to repave some tarmac. And
sounds like Project Cars, isn't it?
Yeah.
I also think, more recently, we all miss Bridge, don't we?
We do.
Oh, completely.
I think it's a great shame. It's there as a monument to its own magnificence, but Silverstone's got some great bits. The Beckett's Complex Cops are fantastic. But Bridge was the one, and a lot of young drivers I talk to now, who, when they were coming up through Formula Renault and GP2 and stuff, they were saying one of the things they really looked forward to was getting to Silverstone and going through a bridge in a properly fast car.
Yeah.
And by the time they got here, Bridge had been consigned to a museum. You know, it's a shame.
I'm sure the late great De Cesaris wouldn't miss it though.
No. Possibly not.
We've got. Before we move on from Silverstone, now Simon, this is another. This is a Simon Aaron
extravaganza.
Special, this is. So you went to Silverstone. This is for the Silverstone Classic press day, wasn't it? Where
yes.
You met Caroon and Mark Webber and Susie Wolfe. All getting kitted up in original period. Or period outfits, which make quite interesting images. I think
they got the size a bit wrong for Mark, didn't they? Because he's a very tall lad, isn't he? So I think he got a bit of a challenging suit.
What did we ask? Was he in ERM? Was he? Was he driving?
Yeah, Mark was in the ERA type, which is one of the three cars that had a centre throttle pedal, which caught him out a couple of times. I mean, they weren't going at competitive speeds, but nor were they dawdling. Yeah, there was some of it they're doing just slow tracking work behind the camera car. At other times, they're going a little bit quicker. And there were times, a couple of times, he said his brain automatically got him to stamp on the centre pedal to slow down, which just made him go faster.
I quite like my favourite bit of that was the quote that he mentioned about saying that he's. When you asked him whether or not he'd want to have a go at a historic race or have a...
Yeah, the version of the quote I printed isn't quite as strong as the answer I got.
Yeah, there were a few more expletives and Australianisms in there, wasn't there?
But Caroon was in his element, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, Caroon was loving it, but again, even he said that he wouldn't want to race something like that. It's another quote in the piece. He, without wishing to spoil it for anyone, but he said that much as he loves doing a bit of historic racing at Goodwood, he maximum 90 brake horsepower, preferably with a roof, you know, St Mary's Trophy.
He's happy with that.
Yeah, he's happy. He's quite happy racing LMP2 cars and stuff, but in terms of history, yeah.
These modern drivers, eh?
We're half an eye on the time. We've got, the McLaren Senna. We don't often do sort of modern cars or road cars with road tests, but the Senna, we thought, probably justified it.
I think if you're going to do one, then this is the one to do, isn't it? Really,
yeah.
With the name and the back history and yeah.
Well, Andrew Frankel's done the review for us, and it's a typically sort of nuanced piece, really, isn't it? It's not. I mean, a lot of the reviews that I've read of this car are sort of kid in candy store. You know, isn't it fantastic? I mean, Andrew does ask the difficult questions, really, doesn't he? I mean, he comes down firmly. Well, I won't ruin it, but it's a mature piece of criticism, really, I think.
Yeah, it's typical Andrew in his element. He takes a very sensible approach to these cars. I mean, they are insane cars, aren't they? They're not for the normal people. They are for out there people. And he's taken a suitably sensible view that maybe the other publications, he says he's putting his best diplomatic head on, sort of shy away from. They tend to go, it's amazing, but you know.
I mean, it is amazing.
Of course. it is. But,
And from the sort of ultra modern, we suddenly slow right down, and Gordon Cruikshank, our editor at large, has done a lovely piece on Pat Appleyard and the Jaguar XK120. You went down for this, didn't you? Well, remind me, where does she live? It looks like it should be in the Cotswolds somewhere.
It is in the Cotswolds, A farm that she didn't take up farming until I think she was in her 50s or mid-50s in another change of career. I mean, she's in her mid-80s now. It was fantastic. So,
woman with her, she's had an incredible life, hasn't she?
To European Rally Championships as a woman and in the 50s is an unspeakable thing.
Yeah, it wasn't the thing, yeah. It's incredible.
We spent the day with her and her son and
got to reunite her with her famous
with the
car.
Which
is a sort of a famous car in itself, isn't it? So to get her back in, sitting in it and enjoying herself. She looked like she had a whale of a time.
She did. She had a lovely time. And then flicking through her scrapbooks of everything she's got printed, it was, you could see her being transported back herself. And to be part of that was fantastic.
She's an incredible, incredible lady. And our lunch this month was Petter Solberg, which Colin Goodwin has written for us. It's funny, we called up Solberg's PR people and said, you know, is he coming over for the World Rallycross and does he want to meet for lunch? And sometimes there's a delay in people getting back to you, but this PR said absolutely he would love to have lunch, and he wants to go to his favourite restaurant in London, which
his
was
an extremely
expensive sushi restaurant, which I'm not going to give the name of here, but it's in Mayfair. My eyes expensive. Watered when I signed off the expenses.
My eyes watered when I put my pin in.
Brilliant interview, isn't it? I mean, he's such a character. I mean, he's never been short of an opinion, but he's got some great stories, hasn't he? Lyndon, you were there shooting this, and sat with them. Yes,
it was brilliant because as soon as we turned up, he went, "I love this feature in the magazine, and I'm so pleased to be part of it." And it was there's a lot of unprintable stories. And he is still a kid at heart. Again, it's like Steve Parrish, but in rallycross form or rally form. But yeah, the stories he told us, and from being dance champion to radio control champion to world champion, it was an enjoyable 3 or 4 hours that he just talked and talked and talked.
He's another one of these guys that's just got an incredible passion for the sport still, hasn't
yeah,
he?
I mean, oh,
he's
God,
been,
yeah.
I mean, we kind of forget that he's been around for quite a while now. We kind of assume he's a young pup, but he's obviously of an age yeah. now where he's had an incredible career. And he's still talking about having another crack at WRC even now, isn't he?
He still
doesn't think that chapter's closed yet, which is incredible. He'll keep going till, you know, he'll be back at Goodwood for, you know, years to come.
I think you're probably right. Moving on, we've got postcard from Le Mans. I think we've covered Le Mans, but we've got the classic picture of Alonso having won the race. We've got Mark has done a fantastic piece on Max Verstappen, just really kind of looking at I mean, we all thought he was obviously, you know, that he's been accused of being kind of slightly reckless. And Mark sort of turns it on its head and says, you know, this hasn't always been the case. You know, he hasn't always been a young, reckless driver in any way. And he questions why it's happening now. And it's he really gets to the, as so often with Mark, he kind of asks the right questions and gets to the root of the problem, doesn't he, Simon?
He does indeed, yeah.
And the frustrating thing with that is that he then obviously we went to press.
He went podium, win. Yes.
Yeah, that's very frustrating.
I wasn't going to mention that.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's a great breakdown of the, you know, the troubled first six or seven races that he had. It's a really good analysis of.
It feels like
why
he's turned a corner a little bit.
It does now. Yeah. Mark, that's a great analysis of the first part of the season.
Maybe Mark's interview made him reevaluate in his own head.
That's quite possible.
This is what I've got to do.
I hope Mark's on commission.
Yeah, I'd like to think that's exactly what happened, Linda. Skipping on, we've got our review of our Hall of Fame evening, which is the Motorsport Magazine's awards evening and event, which this year was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? We had sort of so many. It takes place at the RAC Club in Woodcote Park in Surrey. We had a galaxy of stars all collecting their awards. So we've got some photographic images from that evening.
I think they prefer the term Royal Automobile Club rather than RAC these days.
Thank you, Jack. Maybe we could do that again. Royal Automobile Club.
We'll edit that bit out, don't worry.
Andrew Frankel's road cars. We've got a what have we got here?
We've got Bugattis. We've got Triumph Vitesses in Speed Shop this month. We've got to talk
best
about
thing,
one
best thing in Speed Shop ever.
Talk about one extreme to another. You've got a EB110 right next to a rallying Triumph Vitesse.
You've got to love a Triumph Vitesse.
This is why motorsport's brilliant. You see, this is for exactly that reason.
We've got a slightly tweaked auctions page, looking at giving some auction reviews and previews.
We have our lovely Max Girardo doing an
new
auction
columnist
expert.
Max Girardo, yes. Who's tells it like actually he's got a fantastic story this month, which where he remembers an auction where there's a telephone bidder and a man in the crowd bidding, and the man ended up missing out on a GTO? No,
yeah, something very expensive.
And it turns out that it was his wife. this man's wife that was bidding on the phone. So he got the car, but it cost him a lot more than he thought it would.
At least his wife knew how much he paid for it, though.
Yeah, that's true. We got a 6R4 in our Speed Shop race cars. We've tweaked our Garage Easter pages, so I'm just going to get to that. We've still got our... the Jordan restoration is still ongoing, but we have got a Ford GT40 as our race car restoration. And this is where we are asking restorers if they've got an interesting restoration or have done an interesting restoration in the past to get in touch and tell us their story for the magazine, either race cars or road cars. So have a look at the magazine, and if you think that you've got something you'd like to share with us, please get in touch on the email below. We've got book reviews, we've got models, we've got art, and what's our parting shot this
parting
this
shot is that...
Oh, it's the Le Mans. Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
There you go. As a final sort of half a Le Mans issue, because the Le Mans won't be happening for another year, so... We have to kind of enjoy
this season, though, which is a bit weird.
Was it the end of the season or the beginning, final round, next, yeah. beginning of next?
Yeah.
Or is it?
No, the so end
is
of
it, it's the end of this season of this in season. Yeah. July 19, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's two Le Mans in one season.
Super season, right. I believe WEC call it.
Right.
Well, we started with Le Mans, we shall end on Le Mans.
One quick thing for the website.
Yes.
I've just been told that the new John Barnard book, which is very good, is now available to buy on the shop. And we recently recorded a podcast with him again at the Royal Automobile Club. So you can kind of do what we've just done with his book if you buy it from our shop, and other shops, I'm sure. But so there's also going to be an extract on the website soon, so you can get a feel for the book, listen to the podcast, and then buy it from shop.motorsportmagazine.com.
Well remembered. There we go.
Excellent. So if you're a McLaren fan, you want to find out a bit more about John Barnard, there you basically Motorsport is your one-stop shop.
Exactly. It's all there. Preview, post, and mid.
Brilliant.
and forthcoming lunch.
And forthcoming lunch, which will be in the next September issue.
Yeah. We should work in marketing.
We should. Thank you all very much. Thank you to Jack Phillips, our digital editor. Thank you, Simon, Lyndon, Damon. Please, if you have enjoyed this podcast, rush out, get the new issue of Motorsport Magazine. If you've already got it, I hope this enlightened you slightly as to how the magazines came together. And we'll be back, hopefully, this time next month.
We should also welcome Joe as our editor, as in those 2 months.
Yes, that's a good point. Yes.
Yeah, he didn't mention that, did he?
I'm Joe editor.
Should we go back to the start, reintroduce him and do this again then? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think we should...
Put it on a permanent loop.
Go to lunch.
Thank you all very much indeed.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.